Greetings and welcome to the next installment in our series of Shiurim on Megillat Esther. We are now at the end of chapter 2 of Perek Bet, and there is a very critical little piece, presented almost as a footnote at the end of chapter 2, after we've had this long, laborious, detailed description of the selection of Esther as queen and everything leading up to it. We are then marked with a literary marker that appears several times in Megillat Esther, Bayamim Ahem. It appeared first in the second verse of the entire Megillah, Bayamim Ahem, Keshevet HaMelech HaShirosh, and it established a particular time frame. Now we have Bayamim Ahem, as if to say there's a new era, and the first event that happens in that new era is as follows, Bayamim Ahem, Mordechai Yoshev V'Shar HaMelech. Now, Mordechai Yoshev V'Shar HaMelech doesn't seem to fit the rest of the narrative here until we figure out really what's happening. So Mordechai continues to be sitting B'Shar HaMelech. Again, the ostensible reason he's doing so is because he's clearly a member of the court, as will become painfully obvious at the beginning of chapter 3. And we already deduced that from the fact that he was able to stay near the women's quarters during Esther's period of trial and then afterwards as queen. His being, B'Shar HaMelech, is going to be a critical piece of the story. Katzaf biktan v'teresh, shnei sarisei ha-melech v'shomrei ha-saf, ha-yalakshu l'shto achyad v'melech ha-shirosh. So what happened? Katzaf biktan v'teresh. Now, first of all, one little piece of grammar is, biktan v'teresh is plural. There's two guys named biktan v'teresh. Katzaf means he got angry or in some way acted in an angry manner. But the problem is it's singular. It should be katzu biktan v'teresh. Not katzaf biktan v'teresh, but katzfu biktan v'teresh. Why is it in the singular? So this is a common device that we find often in Tanakh when there is either a group or a pair of people, plural people who act. But it's chiefly one person who acts who leads them and the others follow along. Three quick examples. One of them, Az Yashir Moshe V'nei Yisrael. Moshe and B'nai Yisrael sang, but it's presented with a singular verb. Chazal understand that this means that Moshe led the Shira, and B'nai Yisrael either repeated what he said, or answered repeated the first word that he said, or answered Hallelujah. Masechet Sota, three opinions. But Moshe clearly was leading the singing. Second example, in a very different direction. When Miriam and Aharon speak ill of Moshe in the beginning of chapter 12 of Bamidbar, vatadaber Miriam v'Aharon v'Moshe, not vayidabru, vatadaber in the singular, indicating that Miriam was the one who spoke, Aharon didn't protest, Aharon accepted it, Aharon listened, in some way Aharon was complicit, but Aharon was not the lead speaker. And there, that of course plays out later on in the story, when Miriam is the one who is actively punished, and Aharon is the one who intercedes with Moshe on her behalf. Third example from the Nevi'im, Vatashar Dvarav Varak ben Avinoam, at the beginning of chapter 5 of Shoftim, Dvarah and Barak sing, but it says Vatashar, exactly like Az Yashir Moshe. But there it's not Moshe uvnei Israel, there it's two people, but it's presented as one person singing, because indeed it seems to be Dvarah who's leading the Shira, and Barak is standing with her, Barak is responding, in some way Barak is secondary, and therefore it's Vatashar Dvarah. Here you have, again, katsaf bigtan vateresh, as opposed to katsfu, that they together acted. It is one of them who acted, and the other one comes along for the ride. That doesn't make a critical difference for us, but the fact that there are two of them involved is what makes a critical difference. What happened? They are shnei sarisei ha-melech. As we mentioned earlier in one of the first shiurim, the word saris, which by later biblical Hebrew, and certainly by rabbinic Hebrew, by that period, ends up meaning a eunuch. In its original meaning means shel rosh, somebody who sees the face of the king, somebody who's one of the closer servants or advisors of the king. These are sarisei ha-melech. Now, it could be interpreted as a eunuch, but sarisei ha-melech indicates that it's people who serve the king directly. And they are mishomrei ha-saf. Now, the word saf is an equivoke. It has two different meanings. On the one hand, a saf is a threshold. And therefore, Shomrei HaSaf, and I believe many of the translations read it this way, Shomrei HaSaf means those who guard the threshold, like door guards. On the other hand, in many places in Tanakh, the word Saf, in several places in Tanakh, the word Saf means a cup or basin. Two examples. In Shmuel Bet, Perak Tedvav, when David runs away from Avshalom, he crosses the Yarden, he goes to the town of Machanaim, and there are three wealthy men, Barzillai HaGiladi, Barzillai Mecholati, and Shovi Ben Nachash, and Amiyom Lo Davar, Milo Dvar, come and present him with lots of material and provisions so that he can remain there. And one of the words there is, Sapot V'charim, to say that they're bringing him thresholds would not make much sense. And it's listed among other vessels that be used for food. So therefore, Saf, in that case, would mean something related to food preparation or vessels for food. But the best proof is in Shmot Yudbet, Per Pasuk Chafalov. Immediately after the command of the Korban Pesach, Moshe calls Bnei Israel together, and he directs them about the Korban Pesach. And he says, Yishech the Korban, and then, Utvaltem Badam Asher Basaf. Take the bunch of hyssop, the Agudat Ezov, and dip it in the blood that is in the Saf, in the basin. So Saf is a basin or a cup. Now, reading that back, if Biktan Vaterash Army Shomrei HaSaf, that means they are the one who guard the king's cup. So the ones who guard the king's cup, meaning from being poisoned, are themselves conspiring to kill the king. Well, this immediately demonstrates for us something that we felt from the very beginning of the Megillah, and now we're seeing it, and it's a critical piece of understanding the plot as it unfolds later in the Megillah, which is that within the Persian court, there is lots of intrigue. There are assassination plots. Ahasuerus's paranoia is not totally misplaced. Good. Now, they wanted to find a way to kill Ahasuerus. And you would think that if they are the guys in charge of the cup, it wouldn't be very hard for them to find that. But they nevertheless have to find a contact on the outside who can get them the poison and arrange to get it and arrange to have it at a time when the food is going to somehow fit in so it'll be able to kill them. Whatever plans they have to make. And this is where the weakness of any criminal conspiracy comes in. Because the minute that you involve another person and you make planning, there is always the possibility, first of all, that one of the members of the conspiracy will be either a mole or will be weak-willed, in some way will divulge the plan to others. And of course, there's a much greater likelihood, which is someone's going to find out about the plans anytime something is sent via email or via telephone call or even a whispered conversation. There's always something for someone to overhear, as opposed to one individual who plans a terrible thing. As long as he keeps his plans in his head, there's nobody who can have any idea of it, and that's the weakness, of course, of a conspiracy. Well, that's what happens here, as we see in the next pasuk. Vayivada hadavar leMordechai. Mordechai found out about the plot. How? We'll talk about that in a minute. Vayageid leEsther Hamalka. And he told Esther Hamalka. So now, how did Mordechai tell Esther? We cannot suppose that Mordechai just walked into the palace, walked into the queen's chambers, and said, oh dear Esther, my cousin, there's a plot to kill the king. Because Mordechai has been the one to command Esther to make sure that nobody knows that she's related to him in any way. So therefore, what seems to be the case is that either at some opportunity where the members of the court are meeting with the queen, Mordechai came up and said, Your Highness, this is what's happening. Or else, more than likely, he sent a message with a trusted advisor saying to Esther, and the advisor didn't necessarily know that they're related, or in any way, just saying, take this message to the queen, that indeed there is a plot, these two guys are trying to kill the king. Now, we will get back to the issue of how Mordechai found out, but first of all, we have to ask the question, why is Mordechai sending the message to Esther? Why isn't he sending the message to Ahasuerus? And the answer seems to be quite straightforward, which is that Mordechai is doing everything possible in order to promote the queen's status in the eyes of the king. So now when the queen will be the one who will be the agent for saving the king's life, that will increase the king's trust in her, and she will now be a greater confidant. And what's critical for Mordechai at this point is that whatever concerns he has, that what happened to Vashti will happen to Esther, should now be assuaged at least a little bit. Because now the king will have more trust in Esther because she's been an agent to save his life as opposed to Vashti, who years ago was one who actually hurt the king's status. Good. Vatoma Esther Lamelech v'shem Mordechai. And now Esther returns the favor. She doesn't just come and tell the king, I have some inside information for you, but she says, Mordechai, the member of your court, sent me a message letting me know that there is such a plot. Vayivukasha davar vayimatzei. So they immediately looked into it, and they indeed found that what the report was true, and that there was a plot. These two gentlemen wanted to kill the king. Vayitalushnehem al eitz. Now this is something we should not ignore. The two of them are killed by being put up in a tree. It's not so clear that Vayitalu here really means hanging in the Old West kind of image or of a gallows. It may mean something closer to some sort of not exactly crucifixion because there's not a crossbar, but to being nailed up to the tree. But as we know from Sefer Ezra, this is the punishment in the Persian kingdom for treason. And that becomes a critical plot piece for later on in the interactions between Mordechai and Haman, which we will get to both at the end of Perek Hei and also in the beginning of Perek Zion, in the middle of Perek Zion, when Haman finally is strung up. This, of course, is a very famous bit of foreshadowing, is that Mordechai's saving the king's life was committed to writing in the annals of the king, and therefore, years later, when the king is looking for someone who's loyal, and we will get to that in chapter 6, he finds Mordechai, and Mordechai has not yet been honored, and that, of course, is what ultimately leads to Mordechai's being raised and Haman's downfall. However, a critical piece of the puzzle that we have not yet solved is how Mordechai found out about this plot. So we have essentially several options. Option number one, which the Gemara suggests, is that Mordechai found out through some form of prophecy. In other words, that Bitan Vateresh were acting on the QT. They were not in any way exposing their plans. But somehow God let Mordechai know, and Mordechai then comes and saves the day. That is an opinion presented in Masechet Megillah Daf Zayin, among the many arguments promoting the idea that there is prophecy at play in Megillat Esther. That is not the mainstream approach among Chazal as to what happened. The mainstream approach works as follows. Bigtan Vateresh were two people from another country, Tursim or Tarshim, and they spoke a foreign language, and therefore they felt comfortable freely speaking among the courtiers about their diabolical plans to kill the king, thinking that no one around them would understand, not knowing that Mordechai, being a member of the Sanhedrin, had to master all known languages in the world, and therefore he understood their language, and therefore he brought it to the attention of the queen. There are two difficulties with this explanation read within the Megillah. Difficulty number one is that Bigtan Vateresh operate inside the palace. They operate sarisim, within the king's chambers. And if I'm right that Shomrei HaSaf means the guardians of the cup, even if the other approach is right, that Shomrei HaSaf means guardians of the threshold, they are people who stay deep inside the palace, inside the king's private chambers. Mordechai, in the meantime, as we're told at the beginning of the story, is Yoshev V'Shar HaMelech. He's outside in his offices, outside of the palace gates. So it's not likely that he ever met Bigtan Vateresh, much less was nearby them when they were having a conversation that he overheard and then happened to know their language. The second thing is a piece of human psychology. If somebody has a degrading thing to say about someone else, and he's sitting with somebody who he and that other person share a common and relatively arcane or unique language, and he's quite sure that the person of whom they're speaking and none of their friends understand that language. As an example, two people who are native Hebrew speakers are standing around near some Americans who don't understand a word of Hebrew, and they want to say something insulting. They may feel comfortable saying something in Hebrew. Maybe not. But chances that they are willing to sit there and in comfortably in their own language talk about a plan to kill somebody with such utter confidence that nobody near them even understands a word that they're saying, much less, besides the fact that even if nobody understands, there's a certain shame, a certain deviousness that kind of sets in when you're talking about such things, that makes it very hard to speak about them out in public, even though it's a language we're quite sure that nobody else understands. Therefore, I believe that there is a third approach that we need to take, but an approach that not only is recommended by the text, and is certainly recommended by the events that we saw in chapter 2, but is going to become nearly inevitable, and nearly we're going to nearly be forced to read it this way once we get to the beginning of chapter 4. But that we are is at least one, if not two, shiurim away. And that is as follows. Mordechai, as we saw in chapter 2, spends all of his time outside of the palace gates waiting to find out, or is there to find out, how Esther is doing inside the women's quarters. How's he going to find out from being outside of the palace gates or outside of the women's quarters what's happening inside the women's quarters? The doors aren't open. There aren't signs up outside on the palace gates saying, oh, this girl made it, this girl has another 3 nights until she's going to the king. So how would he find out? The answer seems to be that Mordechai, like many people in the Persian court, had eyes and ears inside the palace, had his own spies, and that's how he was gathering information. That explains how he was able to keep tabs on Esther. That explains how he was able to find out about Bigtan Vateresh's plot. Because again, the minute two people are involved, they speak, they communicate, they cover for each other, other people find out, there's somebody else they're buying from, they're buying the poison from, there are other people involved, that's where the leaks start, and that's where Mordechai can find out about it. Again, this is, at this point, only a suggestion, but when we get to the beginning of chapter 4, we will see nearly ironclad proof that Mordechai does have spies inside the palace to report to him what is going on. He very likely is not the only one who has, but he almost assuredly has. So in any case, this story of Bigtan Vateresh is important for itself because it gets Mordechai written into the books as somebody who is loyal to the king and the king owes a favor to, and that plays out very critically in the middle of the night, 5 years later when the king can't sleep. On the other hand, if it's 5 years after this event, we don't know, but on the other hand, the story of Bigtan Vateresh sets several other things in motion for us. One of them, the awareness that there is a constant tension and intrigue going on in the palace, and there are threats on the king's life, and the instability with which the king lives is a real instability, which will be very critical in the plot development with Haman and Esther. And third of all, that Mordechai himself has some inside information which he knows how to use to his benefit and to the benefit of Esther, and later on will be to the benefit of all of Am Yisrael. Good. Now we begin chapter 3. Now chapter 3, of course, for the children is a very favorite chapter because that's when they can start making noise, when Haman's name is mentioned. And, of course, on a literary level, chapter 3 is very critical because we now spring forward from the events of the third year, which is the first chapter, and the events leading up to the seventh year, which is the second chapter, which are really just setting the stage for the events we care about, which happen between chapter 3 and chapter 9, or chapter the middle of chapter 9, which all take place in the 12th year of the king, almost all of them taking place either in the month of Nisan, from this point on, up until the end of chapter 7, everything will take place within a very short period in the month of Nisan in the 12th year of the king, and then with one little skip at the third month, we're going to jump ahead to the 11th month of the 12th year of the king, and we will see how that plays out. But in the meantime, let's go one step at a time. Achar ha-devarim ha'ele, which again is also a literary marker in the Megillah. The Megillah began with Bayamim Ahem, and then in the middle of the first chapter, after Vashti was dethroned, Achar ha-devarim ha'ele, as a result of these things, or after these things, the king then realized that he needed a queen. I'm sorry, that is at the beginning of the second chapter. So, similarly here, we have Bayamim Ahem, the story of Bigtan Vateresh, And achar ha-dvarim ha-eleh, introducing Haman. Gidal ha-melech ha-chashverosh et Haman ben hamdata ha-agagi va-yin-nasehu. So the king raised up, the king of Hashverosh raised up Haman ben Hamdata Ha'agagi. We're going to talk about these names. Va'yin Nas'ehu, and he raised him up. He elevated him. Va'yasem et kiso mi'al kol asarim asher ito, and he put his throne higher than all of the ministers who were with him. Now the sense of this pasuk, although we don't have ironclad evidence, is that Haman comes from outside of the court. In other words, it's not as if Haman is a member of the court, because we have never heard his name before, although Chazal identified him as Memuchan, and in the beginning of the next lecture, we'll talk about why that identification is so significant and what Chazal meant by that identification, at least what they likely meant by that identification. However, we have not heard of Haman himself by name as being a member of the court till now. Suddenly he is raised up, and he is raised up above all of the other ministers. Now, one thing we have to step back and notice is that this is a politically dangerous, if not suicidal, move for Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is somebody who relies very heavily on his advisors, as we have already seen at the beginning of the Megillah and in the second half of Perak Aleph and at the beginning of Perak Bet, all of the ways in which Ahasuerus relies on his advisors. He's got a close group of advisors, Roei Pnei HaMelech, the ones who see the face of the king. And then, almost as if inviting the likelihood of disharmony and resentment on the part of his closest advisors, he takes someone who either is already a member of that group, or it sounds like wasn't even a member of that group, brings him in and raises him up to be the highest minister in his court. And to make things worse, Pasuk Bet, V'chol Avdei HaMelech, Asher B'Shar HaMelech Koreim Mishtachavim LaHaman. This is not only unprecedented, it's somewhat strange, and if you think about it, quite treacherous, quite seditious, which is that all of the members of the court, called Der Melech, Asher B'Shar HaMelech, have to notice this very carefully. We grew up with the impression that anywhere where Haman went, everybody had to bow down to him. That is not the case. Not everywhere and not everyone. Rather, Kol Avdei HaMelech, all of the servants of the king, meaning the members of the court, Asher B'Shar HaMelech, who are in the palace gates, meaning when they're in their royal offices. Then, Korim Mishtachavim Haman. Korim, which means something like genuflecting, they'd have to bow down, put their head on the ground, and Mishtachavim is to lay prostrate before Haman. Which means that when Haman would come through the royal offices, leaving the king's chambers to go out of, leave the palace guard, the palace, area, the palace grounds, all of the members of the court would have to bow down to him. Now, if you're a member of the court, and suddenly this guy comes in, and he's elevated so quickly to the point where not only he's an equal, but he is your superior, and you have to bow down to him, much as anyone else would do only for the king, I can well imagine that this is going to raise a certain amount of jealousy and resentment and anger on the part of the ministers. Which now brings us back to the question of why did the king write such an order? And I will parenthetically add, if indeed he did. But let's assume for right now that he did. Why did the king write such an edict that everyone has to bow down to Haman? It is a very large question, because it seems so preposterous within the context of any court, and certainly within the context of Ahasuerus's court, where he is so concerned about being usurped and he's so concerned about losing his hold on the throne. What better way to lose your hold on the throne than to grant a member of your court the status of the king that other people should bow down to? Very strange. And then at the end of the pasuk, we get another note. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai would neither kneel, nor would he bow, nor would he lie prostrate. And this, of course, raises a very large question. That, first of all, the assumption of the text, and now you see it very clearly, is that Mordechai is a member of the court. Because otherwise, to say he wouldn't bow down, neither would a lot of other people bow down. They weren't obligated to. The fact that Mordechai wouldn't bow down is seen here and the rest of the text as a violation of his station, which means his station is a member of the court. And Mordechai refused to bow down, and we're not given any reason. By the way, we will never be given the reason why Mordechai does not bow down in the text. Chazal makes several suggestions. Later authors have made other suggestions. I will share with you three suggestions made by Chazal, two which are very much of a sort, and then a third one which is of a very different sort, and point out what the difficulties are of reading this within the straightforward text, and then ultimately make another suggestion. But first, let's get back to the introduction of Haman. I promised that I would talk about his names. The name Haman and Hamdata are names that fit what we know about Persian names from the period. In other words, the orthography is right, and there are names like that that we're familiar with. Generally, when we meet somebody in Tanakh, we meet them, and we talked about this when we met Mordechai, we meet somebody with their name and their patronym, Haman ben Hamdata, and often with an identification either of a city, place, or some sort of tribal or clan association. Which leaves us wondering, what is Ha-Agagi? Is Agagi some sort of a clan name? Haman is the son of Hamdata, and they're all part of some clan called Agag? Or is Haman from a town called Agag? He's an Agagite? Unclear. Agag is not a known nation at the time that we would say there's Paras and Madai, the Persians and Medes and Agagites. We don't have such an association. Of course, rabbinically, within the world of Midrash, Agagi is read very straightforward as a descendant of King Agag, who was the only king ever to be, the only person ever to become a king of Amalek. But this becomes a very difficult association within the context of Tanakh for the following two reasons. First of all, as I said, Haman and Hamdata, these are Farsi names. And Persians are not Semites. You have to remember that Amalek were Semites. Amalek was the grandson of Esav. They are cousins. They are family. And Amalek were Semitic Bedouins who wandered throughout the northern Sinai and the southern Negev. They were in Arad. They were in parts of Sinai. And they were generally, as I said, Bedouins who would raid cities that were left unprotected. Take a look at Shmuel Aleph Perek Lamed, and you could see an example of that. And it's very hard to associate Haman with Amalek, but there's a much greater reason that it's hard to associate him, which is because in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tetvav, which happened a good 550 years before these events, Shaul, the king Shaul, was told to go to war against a particular tribe of Amalek, not all of them. As you see from Perek Lamed, there's a whole other tribe still around that David has to go to battle with, but against one particular tribe of Amalek who has a king named Agag. A king named Agag. And Shaul goes and he wipes everybody out, men, women, children, everything, except for Agag, who he keeps sort of as a trophy and brings him back with him with the spoils of war. And Shmuel immediately cuts him up into pieces, and that is all in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tetvav. So it's very hard to associate any descendants from that event, considering that all the players there, including Agag himself, were wiped out, and there could have been no pregnant relatives left because they were all killed and everyone was killed. That's problem one. Problem two, even if you want to say that Agag means just that he was somehow related to the Amalekim, who were also had an Agag, but not a direct descendant, becomes problematic in light of the Pasuk in Divrei HaYamim Aleph, the first Chronicles, Perak Dalet, Pasuk Mem Gimel, chapter 4, verse 43, which states unequivocally that in the times of Chizkiyahu, that's 8th century BCE, a good 300 years before our events, or 250 years before our events, that he destroyed She'erit HaPleita Asher LaAmalek. The remnants that were left of Amalek were destroyed, and that means that Amalek, as a genealogical identity, by Akut Shirita Pletel Amalek, that as Amalek, as a genealogical and as a tribal identity, exists no more a good 250 years before the events in the Megillah. So, besides the issue of locale and of family identity of Semitic versus Farsi and the fact that they've all been wiped out before that time, makes the association with Agag as being the Agag of Amalek a very difficult one. Nonetheless, Chazal put a lot of emphasis into associating, not only associating Haman with Agag himself, but also then doubling that association of Mordechai and Esther with Shaul, and saying effectively that Purim is the resolution to the tension created in Shmuel Aleph Tetvav when Shaul did not accomplish his mission totally. It was up to Mordechai to finish that job, and we are going to comment on the significance of those Midrashim at the end of our study of Megillah, because it's a very, very critical piece to understand how Chazal build Haman the way that they do, and it is a piece, along with studying the way several characters developed in the Midrash, but for purposes of this series, we will focus only on Haman. In any case, we have already introduced chapter 3. It is a very, very critical introduction, because there are so many things that happen here that are very powerful. But the big granddaddy of all the questions is, again, why Mordechai does not bow down. So I'll share with you several, before closing, I will share with you several of the observations made by the Midrash, and a bit of methodology about studying Midrash, or studying Mefarshim. When the Midrash suggests several explanations, and some of them are a little bit distant from the text itself, in fact, all of them are, it is doing so because it is bothered by something. The Midrash is not just filling in blanks, it is challenged by something, and it is challenged to come up with a response. And the reason it's challenged is very simple. Mordechai's refusal to bow down is not a simple matter. It is a very, very weighty matter, because the consequences of his refusal to bow down, as we know, end up being the threat of annihilation of the Jewish people. And one could argue, if Mordechai just didn't bow down once and Haman just went nuts and as a result of that signed a decree to kill the Jews and that was the end of the story, I can understand Mordechai that day, for some reason, made such a decision. But Mordechai was obstinate about not bowing down, and even after the decree was written, and as we will see in chapter 4, Mordechai knew that the decree was written, he knew why the decree was written, nonetheless, he very defiantly refused to bow down to Haman. Now you've really got to ask, what right does Mordechai have to not bow to Haman, and as a result of that, continue to endanger the Jewish people? Theoretically, it should have been the case that the minute that Mordechai found out that as a result of his refusal to bow down, the Jewish people were under the threat of Haman's decree, he should have come to Haman and begged his forgiveness and said, I didn't know and I didn't see and I didn't hear and I wasn't there that day, whatever excuses he wants to give, and then to bow down to him and remain bowing down to him. So let's hear what the possible arguments are. So one argument that people commonly come up with is the Jews don't bow down to people. Anybody who looks through Tanakh will see how untrue this is. Is that bowing down to people, and bowing down doesn't mean just moving your head down. It means lying on the floor, prostrate in front of someone. It's something that many of the greatest people in Tanakh do. Who do we have greater than Moshe Rabbeinu? And yet Moshe Rabbeinu bows in front of his father-in-law, who, by the way, is a pagan priest. And nonetheless, Moshe greets Yitro by bowing down to him. Avraham, when negotiating with the Hittites over the piece of land that later becomes Marat HaMachpelah, frequent basis, every time that they reach another step in the negotiations, Vayishtachu Avram, the Fam Aretz, Avram bows down. That doesn't mean he just lowered his head. That means he got down on the ground and he prostrated himself before these people. So we see that sort of action, there is not untoward, it's not prohibited, it's perfectly acceptable action before another person. Even a person, as I mentioned, who is not Jewish, even a person who may be a member of a nation that ultimately you're going to have to annihilate, like the Chitim, perhaps even a pagan priest like Yitro. Nonetheless, you're showing honor to another person. There's nothing wrong with that. That's first of all. So now the Midrash, which also shows up in Masachat Sanhedrin, one of the Midrashim in Midrashei Esther indicates that Haman had woven an image of idolatry into his clothes. So that every time that he walked out and people bowed down to him, they were really bowing down to idolatry. there are two difficulties with reading this into the text of the Megillah. Difficulty number one is that there is no mention whatsoever of any of that here. And if that were the case, then Haman would then accuse Mordechai of not properly respecting the religion, not about violating his own personal honor. So the fact that the omission of any mention of this idolatry is a little bit of a difficulty in the text. But a greater difficulty is that what seems to play out quite clearly is that Haman is driven by one thing, and that one thing is ego and his pride. And how will it promote his ego and his sense of power if when he gets people to bow down, they're really not bowing to him, they're bowing to something else that he happens to be wearing that's not him, that's an idol. The third piece of the puzzle is that it's not all that clear that if somebody is somebody otherwise worthy of respect, political leader or whoever it might be, who happens also to be, let's say, a religious Christian wearing a cross, that I can't show deference to him. I'm not showing deference to the cross, I'm showing deference to the man. He happens to be wearing a cross. Doesn't mean that I can't nicely greet and bow my head a little bit when I meet a bishop who I want to, who is a friend of Israel, and I want to say hello to him and greet him nicely. The fact that he's wearing a cross doesn't mean I'm not going to bow my head to him. I'm not bowing to the cross, I'm bowing to him. So that's a problem with that. There is a somewhat similar midrash. This is the one quoted by Rashi in his commentary on the Megillah, but both the first one, which the Ben Ezra quotes, and this one, which Rashi quotes, show up in Esther Rabbah, is that Haman declared himself to be a god. Not that he had Avodah Zarah on his body, but rather he declared himself to be a god. This, of course, is difficult for the same reasons I just mentioned, along with another reason, which is it's not all that clear that if a person declares himself to be a god, that statement has any meaning whatsoever. It's one thing if a person wears an accoutrement of idolatry, a cross or something like that, fine. Person declares himself to be a god, the person just talking nonsense. So it's a little unclear why that would really be a problem for Mordechai to bow down in such a circumstance. The other very different answer that the Midrash gives is from a different Midrash to Midrash, which is known as the Targum Sheni of Esther, which is, I believe, an 8th or 9th century work. In the Targum Sheni of Esther, there is a long story told, which has its antecedents in much earlier literature because it shows up in early Midrashim in fragments, that Mordechai and Haman had both been generals in Ahasuerus' army in earlier days. And at one point, Haman ran out of rations, and he came to Mordechai and said, I need some rations for my men. Mordechai said, I'm not going to give them to you. To make a long story short, Haman agreed to sell himself as a slave to Mordechai, and they indeed even wrote the decree on the bottom of Mordechai's shoe. So that every time that Haman came out, Mordechai said, I'm not going to bow down to this guy. He's my slave. And then he would, when Haman would come out, he would point to the bottom of his foot as if to remind Haman what's written there, and Haman would get furious. Now, this is a wonderful, wonderful agada. The difficulty of it is it makes Mordechai's behavior all the more enigmatic. How is it that because of your own personal pride and your unwillingness to bow to a guy who you own as a slave, you're ready to endanger all of Am Yisrael? Very, very difficult. So in Yirtzeh Hashem, next week, in the Shir on Monday, we will go further into Perek Gimel. We will get at least to Pasuk Zayin, if not to the end of the Perek, and see some very, very interesting things in the development of the animosity between Haman and Mordechai, and which leads ultimately to the terrible decree against Bnei Yisrael. And then, at some point, there I will suggest yet another answer as to why Mordechai did not bow down to Haman. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos. I'll see you on Monday.